Hello and welcome to Fantastic Fights, the podcast about a middle-aged man playing adventure game books out loud on the internet. That middle-aged man is me, Hieronymus J. Doom, and this time we're playing Curse of the Mummy, the 59th and final book from the original run of Fighting Fantasy. We have arrived, not at the end, but at an inflection point, the point at which it must have seemed at the time like the great adventure was finally over. Happily, we know that wasn't the case, but this still seems like an opportunity to pat myself on the back for making it this far. I wasn't sure that I would when I started out, and it's very much thanks to my listeners and patrons that I've kept going to hit this particular milestone. Speaking of patrons, I have a new patron to thank. Anthony Jones, thanks so much for your support. It means a great deal to me. All patrons get to enjoy the various game books written by members of the Doom household, and I genuinely think my most recent book, Mutiny Most Merited, is the best game book I've written so far. Also, do not forget that there's still time to vote on the entries for the Lindebaum Prize, though the deadline is beginning to loom. There's a whole host of wonderful short game books for you to enjoy and rate, and even if the deadline for the 2025 competition has passed when you're listening to this, you should still go and play a few of the entries anyway, because there are some absolute gems in there this year. Now, let's get down to business. Curse of the Mummy was released in 1995 and was written by Jonathan Green, with both cover and interior art by Martin McKenna. The cover shows the titular mummy wearing a fancy headdress and looming at the viewer in an attitude that conveys either spectral menace or someone caught in the middle of a game of charades. The creature has an expression of morbid misery, which leads me to believe he's definitely been forced to play charades after some tedious family get-together. It's got quite a lot of dynamism, but the background has a composite look to it which makes it seem oddly cheap, which is a shame, considering how nicely the mummy itself has been rendered. That, I think, is actually an artifact of the Wizard re-release, which is the version I'm playing. The original art doesn't have quite the same issue and also has a slightly more old-school horror vibe to the font used for the title. Let's take a look at the rules. We have skill, stamina and luck all present and correct, along with a single new stat, which is poison. This represents the amount we've been poisoned, and if it ever hits 18, we die. It's a simple mechanic, but also a redundant one because we've already got a mechanic that could represent gradually dying. It's called stamina. On spec, it seems like you could easily replace this with stamina loss, but it's entirely possible it will work better in play. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it, but I think if you're going to do a second stamina score, it helps if they're conceptually different from the first one. Fear in House of Hell is a good example of doing this well, because there's plenty of times when you can imagine manipulating the fear score without manipulating the stamina score at the same time. But with poison, it usually feels like stamina loss would also be appropriate, and it seems weird that you can, in theory, get poisoned 17 times and suffer zero mechanical penalties, only to keel over instantly the next time you brush up against a nettle. But I may be doing Jonathan Green a disservice here. It may feel perfectly good in the playing. We also get different rules for fighting more than one opponent at the same time, which has become something of a Fighting Fantasy tradition in later books. Here you are essentially doing individual fights with each of the opponents, but only getting to damage one of them. Once you've selected the one you're actually going to stab, in other fights rolling higher than the monster just represents fending it off. I prefer versions of this where you only roll once for yourself, but this is a perfectly reasonable way to represent bigger fights that minimises cognitive load, since you don't have to remember all the different monster attack scores when rolling for your own attack score. Lastly, we get the bad news that we only start with 5 gold pieces and no provisions or lantern. I don't actually mind this at all. We've seen a lot of books recently where provisions were used as a resource to demonstrate the passage of time. This feels like maybe it's not going to do that, which makes a nice change of pace. It does make me worry that we might have a shopping trip in our future, though. I said earlier I'm playing the Wizard re-release of Curse of the Mummy, which I'm aware fixes a few relatively minor issues with the original print run. It's also one of the only books from the tail end of the first run that can be got for a sensible amount of money. It's almost like reprinting things increases the supply and thereby lowers the price. It's great to be able to play this book in a paper copy rather than in the various scans and whatnot I've been using for recent episodes. I'd love to see someone reprint the entire original run one day. Even official ebooks would be a great resource to have to make these wonderful books more accessible by a new generation. I have rolled up my character, who I've decided to call Fallible Fringe Flopper, because that sounds like a suitably heroic name. They have a skill of 8, a stamina of 21, and a luck of 12. They have 0 poison, 5 gold, and not even a cheese sandwich to call their own. With all that out of the way, let's play Curse of the Mummy. Background. Facing its twin Halak on the other side of the mouth of the Bay of Elkor, Rimmon is the capital of the Pirate Coast. With their ramshackle mazes of streets and twisting alleyways, the two ancient towns perched on the steeply sloping sides of twin mountain peaks are a haven for buccaneers and renegades. Even the feared pirate Captain Garius of Halak has his secret hideout somewhere along the coast. Feel as though, if you're a pirate, naming yourself after where you're from feels as though it might be a bad plan when people start trying to track you down, for instance. It's not a very secret base if you're kind of giving away that it's somewhere near Halak. It was a crew of these scurvy pirates who attacked the merchantman on which you had gained passage, travelling north from Cain Lesh Mar and making for Port Blacksand. Everyone take a drink. First reference of Port Blacksand. Your vessel was sunk, and all on board were left to the mercy of the sea. After several days, you were washed ashore, as far as you know, the only survivor of the wreck. With only your sword and enough money to keep you from starvation for just a few days. Finding yourself not far from Rimmon, you made your way to the town, hoping to find work guarding a caravan heading north. But you missed the last one to leave for several weeks by only a day. So instead, you decided to find a gainful employment that might earn you your passage on another ship headed for Port Blacksand. Then you saw a notice nailed to a wall in the Adventurers Guild. The notice read, "Brave warrior required for dangerous mission into hills around the Desert of Skulls. Great rewards guaranteed. Apply, Jeren Farr, the Monkey's Paw." You made some discreet inquiries about this possible employer and discovered he is an archaeologist of some notoriety. He does not enjoy a very good reputation among the adventuring fraternity of Rimmon and is considered by most to be no better than a tomb robber. It is a bit rich for adventurers to describe someone as a tomb robber. How many times over the course of the Fighting Fantasy run have we literally robbed stuff from tombs? I mean, it's a lot. Apparently, if you're stealing from tombs in order to just sell it for beer money, that's fine. But if you're stealing from tombs to put it in a museum, that's a problem. Anyway, however, times are hard, so you decided that you had nothing to lose and made your way to the Monkey's Paw, a seedy drinking house in one of the poorer parts of Rimmon. Entering the bar, you find the clientele as shady-looking as you would expect. The landlord looks as if he would cut your throat as soon as serve you a drink. You mention Jeren Farr's name, and with a grunt, the landlord directs you to a man sitting at a table by himself. Jeren Farr, a moustached man in his mid-30s, looks as if he too has known his fair share of hardship. He is tanned from days of toil in the baking lands at the edge of the Desert of Skulls, and his sleeveless leather jacket, like the rest of his clothes, is worn and dusty, and he wears a battered, wide-brimmed hat to keep off the sun. Having made your introductions, you sit down opposite the man. I mean, fair play, they have absolutely nailed the description of an archaeologist. He just needs a t-shirt extolling the value of real ale or Scandinavian metal, and you've absolutely got someone I've met.
Have you heard of the curse of Acheris?
Jaren asks. You shake your head.
Then I will tell you of the legend. Centuries ago, before the drowning of Atlantis by the gods, the three major continents of Titan, Alanzia, the Old World, and Kul, were all joined together as one massive continent, which early records called Irritaria. At this time, at the southern edge of what we now call the Desert of Skulls, there existed a small desert kingdom called Jurat. The people of Jurat, who worshipped a whole clutch of animal-headed gods, carried out the practice of mummifying their dead rulers before burying them in great tombs in the mountains, along with fabulous riches. Acheris was the last of the rulers of Jurat to be buried before the parting of the lands. He favoured Cythera, the goddess of evil above all the gods of Jurat, and was the cruelest tyrant the kingdom has ever known. He demanded human sacrifices for his goddess, and was said to commune with dark spirits and bring the mummies of his ancestors back to life. When at last he died, poisoned by one of his enemies, he was aged 156. As he lay dying, Acheris called on Cythera, saying one day he would return and all would suffer under his curse. Plague of flies, snakes and scorpions would come upon the land, the daytime sky would be black as night, and the cities would be swallowed by the desert. Legend says he was buried somewhere, surrounded by piles of priceless treasure in one of the most astonishing tombs ever constructed, one which included many terrible death traps.
Interesting as all this is, what does it have to do with you wanting to hire a brave warrior for a dangerous mission? You ask the archaeologist, being, to be fair, quite soft in the head.
Let me explain,
Jaren continues.
5 days ago, I was working at a site on the edge of the rocky hills bordering Rimmon, when a man staggered into my camp. He looked terribly dehydrated, suffering from sunstroke, and he looked as if he'd been in a battle. I gave him water, tried to make him as comfortable as possible. As soon as he'd recovered a little, he told me what had happened to him. He was part of a group of explorers who had been investigating the lands at the edge of the desert. He told me that at a ruined temple by an oasis, they uncovered an inscription that revealed the location of the lost tomb of Acheris with all its treasures. They set out to find it at once, but they'd not gone very far when they were ambushed by a group of people swathed in red robes that bore the emblem of a golden cobra. The rest of his party were either captured or killed, and he was left for dead. When it was safe, he started the difficult journey back to Rimmon to warn the people of what was happening, but he only made it as far as my camp. He died next morning.
Absorbed by Jera's tale, you ask. So who were these red-robed attackers?
Members of the cult of the Cobra,
he replies.
The cult was the priesthood that worshipped Cythera and Jurat, and they were Acheris's most loyal followers. It has always been their aim to find Acheris's tomb and resurrect their long-dead master so that he can call down his curse upon the land and reclaim his kingdom. The secret sect has been revived in the last decade, and it looks as if the cult of the Cobra have at last found his tomb and are preparing for the king's return. They must be stopped, or all will suffer the curse of Acheris. I need one brave warrior to accompany me and infiltrate the cult without their knowing to thwart their evil plans. If you will help me, and should we succeed, the treasures of the tomb will be our reward.
"Of course I will help you carry out your plan," you say. The possible riches to be found in the tomb could make you wealthy beyond your wildest dreams. But more important than that, the cult must be stopped from bringing such an evil back into the world. There is no time to lose. You both leave the monkey's paw immediately to prepare for your quest. The pair of you have not gone far along a narrow back street on your way towards the markets of Rimmon when a figure covered from head to toe in fine red robes drops silently from the top of a wall to the ground in front of you, and a harsh, hissing voice behind you says,
"Not so fast, Jiren Far."
So that is the background. A bit wordy, a bit overlong for what is a relatively simple setup of trying to find a hidden tomb and rob it of its wealth, whilst at the same time saving the world. But yeah, fine. Perfectly serviceable. Nicely written, of course. Jonathan Green, nothing if not a decent writer. So we're on to section one. You spin around to see two more people dressed in the same manner as the first, only their eyes visible between the swathes of red cloth. Their robes bear the emblem of a rearing golden cobra. They must be members of Acheris's evil cult. Each of the cultists is armed with a long curving sword, and an assortment of other silent death weapons hangs from their belt.
"They must have discovered the explorer survived their attack and followed his trail to my camp,"
Jiren whispers under his breath.
"And from there they must have followed me to Rimmon. What shall we do?"
"Will you draw your sword and run at the cultists' leader? Draw your sword and stand your ground, or try to escape? There is a picture of the cultists. They look a lot like ninjas, I have to say. It's a decent bit of work from Martin McKenna, but I think not quite his best. There's a slightly crude, cartoonish vibe to the work, which I don't really associate with him. But it's still fine. It still conveys exactly what it needs to convey. And his almost trademark use of light and shade is very strongly on display here. So what are we going to do? I think we're going to start with bravery and draw our sword and run at the cultist leader. Cut the head off the snake and see if the rest of the ninja types fold. Yelling, you run at the leader of the cultists. At the last moment, he deftly sidesteps out of your way and you end up sprawling in the dirt. Test your luck. Well, my luck is 12, so I am automatically lucky. Luck now 11. You manage to get to your feet before the cultists attack. Separated, Far takes on one of the Red Robe assassins, while the other two advance on you. You must fight them both at the same time. The first cultist has a skill of 7 and a stamina of 7, and the second cultist has a skill of 7 and a stamina of 6. So, fighting them both at the same time, this should be fine. I had forgotten I've only got a skill of 8. What a rubbish character I have rolled up. Okay, well, we'll see what happens when I roll some dice. Slightly embarrassingly, I have died to the first fight in the game book. I reduced one of the cultists to 2 stamina, but yeah, turns out not rolling good today, and they just straight up murdered me. So obviously, a little bit soon to call an end to this recording, so incredibly early doors, I'm going to invoke the sausagey finger bookmark rule. I'm also going to take the executive decision to effectively re-roll my skill until I get a better result than 8. And that leaves me with a skill of 11, which is much better. So, genuinely embarrassing end to that adventure technically, but hopefully fallible Fringe Flopper the second will have more luck, and we will assume that we have successfully killed one of the cultists. What a disaster. As your opponent falls, so does Jiren's. Before you can stop him, the third cultist turns tail and flees towards the markets. What will you do now? Will you pursue the cultist and try to stop him before he can warn the rest of the sect? leave Rimmon immediately with the intention of heading the cultist off on the way to the tomb, or ignore the cultist and visit the markets to prepare for your quest? Well, I think we need to try and pursue the cultist to try and stop him before he can warn the rest of the sect. Ah, there is a visit to a market in our future, potentially. If there's any way to avoid that, I am going to take it. You and Farr chase along the back street after the cultist, but lose him among the hustle and bustle of an animal market. Then you catch sight of a robed figure on the opposite side of the square moving away from you. As you elbow your way through the crowd, you see a trader's cage swing open, and with a roar, its occupant leaps into the crowd. As the throng of people vanishes, you and Farr find yourselves alone in the middle of the square, facing a newly escaped black lion. Angry at having been locked up in a confined space, and who can blame it, and confused by its unnatural surroundings, the beast strikes Farr with one great paw, knocking him to the ground. You have no choice now but to try and stop this enraged animal. So, the black lion has a skill of 9 and a stamina of 9. For the second time in about 2 minutes, I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated the black lion. It got 2 lucky hits on me, reducing my stamina to 17. I am still not rolling well this adventure. As the black lion slumps to the ground, a great cheer goes up from the onlookers. Jeren is not badly wounded, but because you are distracted by having to fight the deadly beast, the cultist has got away. You will now have to try and head him off on the way to the tombs, or give up the chase and visit the market to prepare for your quest. So we'll try and head him off on the way to the tombs. Leaving Rimmon, Jeren, Farr and yourself set out round the steep Uron Heights before turning north. As you walk, Jeren shows you a crude map of the area around the southern edge of the Desert of Skulls and points to a sketch of an oasis near a temple.
I was able to get the location of the temple from the explorer before he died, but not that of the tomb, says Jeren. But if we can find the temple, we should find the inscription that reveals the whereabouts of the tomb. I've also heard rumours of a shaman who lives in the rocky hills to the east at a place called Spirit Rock. If we could find him, he may be able to help us in our quest. However, we'll leave the choosing of the way until it becomes necessary.
After 2 days of walking, during which time you must eat 2 meals or lose 2 stamina points for each meal missed, you reach the site of Jeren's camp. I have no food, so we will lose 4 stamina. Should have gone to the market. Stamina now 13. Jeren has hidden a tent and bedroll, so at dusk you settle down for a night under canvas. You are awoken several hours later by an ominous clacking sound coming from somewhere close to the tent. There is a sudden scuttling noise, and then you hear Jeren cry out. In an instant, you are outside the tent. In the moonlight, you see the archaeologist struggling in the grip of a huge pincer belonging to a 3-meter-long monstrosity covered in shiny black armour. The giant scorpion's sting rears up over its back as large as a man's head. As you watch, the deadly sting of the overgrown arachnid lashes forward and strikes Jeren in the chest, and the man stops struggling at once. You run to the scorpion and strike its claw. Releasing its grip on Jeren's body, the grotesque creature turns to attack you. So, there is a picture of Jeren caught in the claws of the giant scorpion. He does sort of look like he's just waving at you because he's having a really nice time. Again, I'm going to go out on a limb and say this is not Martin McKenna's very strongest work. I mean, it's still fine. Martin McKenna phoning it in is still better than a lot of people on their best day, but this is not his finest work. Anyway, I've got to fight a giant scorpion, which has a skill of 8 and a stamina of 10. Each claw can attack independently, so conduct this fight as if you are up against 2 opponents, each with a skill of 10. If at any time the scorpion's attack strength is 22, turn at once to this section. Okay, so it's got a skill of 8, but actually it's got 2 skills of 10. Is that an error? Does it sort of mean that the mouth parts have got a skill of 8, but the claws have got a skill of 10? I guess that maybe is how I will read it. Yeah, we'll treat it as having a skill of 10, I guess, for each claw. Yeah, we'll roll some dice. I have defeated the giant scorpion. It reduced me to 5 stamina. At no time did its attack strength hit 22, so I think I've avoided the big stinger. This is going super, super badly. Makes a really interesting contrast with the last bonus episode, where one of my comments was how impressed I was at their restraint in the number of fights. This is not showing restraint in the number of fights at all. As the giant scorpion twitches its last, you run over to help Jiren. He is barely alive.
"This is the end for me," he gasps. "But you must go on. Stop the cult of the Cobra. Beware the curse of Acheris."
With that, the brave archaeologist dies. The next morning you bury Jiren Farr, marking the grave with his old battered hat, offering a prayer to the gods for his departed soul. At the same time, you swear to do all you can to stop the evil sect and prevent Acheris' return. Taking Jiren's map with you, you set off again, heading north. By mid-morning, your path is becoming gradually steeper as it leads you into the rocky foothills of the mountains which border the Desert of Skulls. You continue to follow the dusty trail as it turns towards the northeast. A few kilometres on, standing at the top of a ridge, you see that several semicircular tiers of stone seats have been cut out of the base of the hillside in front of a raised platform and a low, rectangular stone building. Close to the seemingly deserted site lie fallen pillars and the remains of walls. Do you want to descend the hillside and investigate the ruins, or would you rather continue on your way? Oh, I am very intrigued. And maybe it's a tomb, like not the tomb we're going for, but a different one. And I can indulge in a spot of the tomb robbing that apparently adventurers look down on. You scramble down the slope until you are standing in the sandy arena in front of the platform. The facade of the low building is decorated with the busts of people, or possibly gods, standing in recessed alcoves.
"Who dares trespass in the theatre of the gods?"
The booming voice makes you jump almost out of your skin in surprise. The words echo around among the empty tiers of seats, but the voice itself seems to be coming from a dark doorway in front of the building. What will you do now? Will you answer, apologising for trespassing? Answer, demanding that the owner of the voice show himself? Say nothing and approach the doorway, or leave the theatre of the gods and continue your quest? Is this going to be a Wizard of Oz, there's nobody actually behind the curtain, or rather, there's someone small just doing a big voice behind the curtain, or is this going to be an actual serious threat? Regardless, I'm going to apologise for trespassing anyway. Good manners cost nothing. A short figure appears in the open doorway, dressed in plain grey robes and wearing a mask with a grotesquely exaggerated features.
"What do you want of the great Crano?" the little man booms.
When you ask him if he can aid you in your quest, ask him what he knows of the shaman, attack him or leave the ruined theatre. I think I'll ask him a specific question, which is what he knows of the shaman.
"The shaman of the Wilderlands has his abode at Spirit Rock, a league to the east. But be warned, the lands beyond here are home to all manner of primitive and inhuman tribes."
You thank Crano for his information. Make a note of Crano's warning on your adventure sheet. Now will you ask him whether he can aid you on your quest or leave without further delay? I might as well ask him if he can aid me on my quest. You give Crano a brief outline of your mission without revealing too many important details.
"Indeed I may,"
he says, removing the mask and revealing himself to be middle-aged, grey-haired and balding. He leads you through a doorway into the stone building. You find yourself in a long room full of pieces of faded scenery and other theatrical props.
You know, I used to be one of the greatest actors Alanzia has ever seen, Crano says. I have played all the great parts. Duke Merion of Calamere, Quor the Sorcerer, Vorga the Pirate Lord. You understand I mean no harm, really, what with the mask and the dramatic performance. I just prefer to spend my retirement away from unappreciative audiences.
You are startled to see a huge saber-toothed tiger pad over to the actor and lick his hand.
Don't mind Cleomena, Crano adds. She's perfectly loyal. Anyway, about my aiding you, I've collected a number of interesting pieces. I would gladly swap some trinket you may possess for two of these items.
Crano would like any one of the following: a brass telescope, a healing draught, some oil of lotus, or a crystal pyramid. In return, you may choose two items from the list below if you decide to trade. Having chosen your items, turn to the paragraph relevant to each object to find out more about your new possession. So there's a papyrus scroll, a carved bone horn, an old lamp, a statuette of a god, a large bronze key, and a sealed black bottle. I can afford none of those because I have nothing in my pocket apart from some loose change. I feel as though the lamp would be handy. I feel as though keys are always handy. Papyrus scrolls could equally be handy. Lacking either a brass telescope, a healing draught, or oil of lotus, or a crystal pyramid, I guess we will just leave the ruined theatre of the gods. After meandering through barren rocky hills, the track descends through a boulder-strewn pass and divides, one branch continuing northeastwards, while the other leads directly towards a line of several high peaks in the east. Looking at Geron's map, you see that the route you are now on goes towards the temple, while the new path to the right should take you to the Shaman and Spirit Rock. Will you continue northeastwards or take the right-hand fork? I think we'll go and try and find this Shaman. We've been warned that there are dangerous tribes, but we're going to have to get some help somewhere along the way. So we will take the right-hand fork. As the sun reaches its highest point, you rest for a few minutes in the shade of a great slab of rock. You may eat provisions here if you wish. The whole landscape looks as if a giant's game of knucklebones had been played here. The only signs of life in this scorching wilderness are the occasional lizard running over the rocks in search of beetles, and a lonely bird of prey soaring on the warm thermals above you in the cloudless azure sky. The only sound is made by a cool breeze, but it isn't the only sound. You are suddenly aware of a low growling coming from somewhere among the rocks behind you. Do you want to investigate the source of this noise, or will you hurriedly move on eastwards again? I've got 5 stamina. I think it's time to take a powder. I assume it's some sort of local bit of wildlife that we'll just try and eat, mate. So we will skedaddle as fast as we can. You trudge on through the heat of the day, further into the rugged hills. The only vegetation that grows in this hot region is the occasional scrubby bush and fleshy green, thick-stemmed succulent covered in spines. You notice one of these plants growing close to the track you are following. Some species are very nutritious, but you do not know if this is such a one. Do you want to cut yourself a piece of the plant to eat, or continue on your way? Well, I do need more stamina badly. There's not much to lose at this point. I'm going to cut myself a piece of plant to eat. Using your sword, you slice the top of the plant, and removing the spines, bite into its juicy flesh. The bitter taste makes you wince, and before you know what you are doing, you have swallowed some of the liquid. As well as being protected by its spines, the barbed thorn has a second defence against would-be diners. It is poisonous. Add 2 to your poison total and deduct 3 points from your stamina. So stamina now 2, poison now 2, and yes, it could just have been 3 stamina loss there. Like, you can make poison into a feature of the book without needing to necessarily give it mechanical support. Anyway, spitting the rest of the plant out, you hurry on your way, leaving the toxic barb thorn behind. Either this is really hard or I'm an idiot. I could go either way. We'll find out, I guess, on subsequent attempts. The path you are following leads towards a narrow, steep-sided gorge, a land on either side of it rising up to the cliff tops. Do you have Crano's warning written on your character sheet? I surely do. So there's something I got right. Remembering the actor's words about the primitive inhabitants of these parts, you can well imagine the gorge would make a perfect place from which to ambush unwary travellers. Will you carry on directly through the gorge regardless, or will you detour to one side and climb up the clifftop in order to avoid the route between them? We will take the latter of those options. I think the detour is a good plan under these circumstances. You half walk and half climb towards the clifftops. In a few places you slip, sending a cascade of stones down into the gorge, but eventually you reach the top safely. You must now eat a meal or lose 2 stamina points. So, stamina now, 0. I have died again. This is such a doomed adventure. Again, far too early to be calling a halt. We will set my stamina to 12. That seems reasonable. And continue. That's one of the most ignominious deaths I think I've ever experienced. Just climbing to the top of the hill, going, I have made it! And then keeling over from exhaustion and lack of nutrition immediately on surmounting the top. Looking down at the landscape from your lofty vantage point, you can see clearly as far as the edge of the hills to the desert of skulls and as far south as the Bay of Elcor. Do you have a brass telescope? I do not. Crouching low against the top of the cliffs, you encounter no hostile denizens of these parts. And once past the gorge, you follow the stony track down towards the lower ground and rejoin your original path. As you reach the top of yet another ridge, you pass an outcrop of rock, and suddenly your goal becomes visible. At the edge of a vast mesa that stretches to the east and north, rising up between 2 of the sandy hills, is a tall pinnacle of rock, its sides almost vertical. A massive boulder, which appears to be precariously balanced, rests on its flat top. The boulder is covered in swirling patterns formed by veins of some crystalline substance. There is a strong aura of elemental energy about the place, and a voice inside your head tells you that this must be Spirit Rock. A thin trail of smoke rises into the air from the top of the boulder, and you can just make out a small cave entrance at its base where it rests on the pinnacle. The shaman must live at the top of the rock, and from all appearances, you assume that he is there at the moment. However, the only way you are going to gain access to the cave is to scale the pinnacle. Are you determined to seek the shaman's aid, and do you want to make the dangerous climb? Would you rather abandon this approach and set off in search of a temple once more? No, I've come this way, you know, sunk cost fallacy and all that, but I've made it this far. I didn't come this far to simply turn back. I'm going to try the dangerous climb. I mean, I've already died twice. Honestly, this holds no fear for me. The sun is low in the sky by the time you begin your ascent. In this light, Spirit Rock takes on a deep red hue, and the veins of crystal sparkle as they catch the sun's last rays. Do you have a rope and grapple? Nope, I have literally nothing. Should have gone to the market. I'm so tired of markets. I'm so tired of picking out what might be useful from a list of things where I can only afford some of them. One of my least favourite tropes by this point. So pleased to be able to avoid it, irritated that it appears to be almost required. Choosing a route up the side of Spirit Rock, which seems to offer you the greatest number of hand and footholds, you climb towards the cave entrance 50 metres ahead of you. Test your skill 3 times. Once, I get a 7. Twice, I get a 3. Thrice, I get a 5. Are you successful every time? I am indeed. Nice to see my luck changing for the better there. You manage to make your way safely to the cave entrance at the base of the great boulder. After a few metres, the rough-hewn tunnel opens out into a vast chamber in the centre of the massive boulder. A fire burns in the middle of the chamber, the smoke rising up through a hole in the roof. Sitting cross-legged on the far side of the fire is the figure of a man, his head bowed.
"Who seeks Lopar, the shaman of Spirit Rock?" the man asks from the shadows.
Sensing the man's aura of goodness, you announce yourself.
"And what is your purpose in seeking me?"
he asks. Quickly, you explain your quest to Lopar. When he looks up suddenly by the flickering firelight, you see his head is that of a dog. Woven into his fur are various beads and feathers, and his hands resemble paws. So there is a picture of Lopar the shaman with the dog head. Best bit of art we've seen so far. Sat cross-legged, inscrutable in front of us, decked in beads. Yeah, really solid bit of work.
"Knowledge can be a dangerous thing in the hands of the ignorant," the shaman says sagely. "Having braved Spirit Rock, you must prove that you are worthy to receive my wisdom by solving my riddle."
Startled, you listen to Lopar's conundrum.
"No army can stand against my might. I am greater than wind or sea. All succumbs just as day follows night. High mountains turn to dust before me."
If you know the answer to the riddle, convert the letters of the answer into numbers using the code A equals 1, B equals 2, etc. Add the numbers together, then turn to the paragraph whose number is the same as the total. So, time would be the obvious answer. I'm going to go with time. Time is indeed the correct answer.
"That is correct," Lopar murmurs. "Now sit and I shall tell you what I know of the cult of the cobra and the curse of Acheris."
You sit opposite the dog-headed shaman and listen to his tale.
"The cult of the cobra are followers of Cythera, the ancient Jatarian goddess of evil. Cythera is in fact a demon prince Sith in the guise of a four-armed woman with a snake's head. The Jatarians worshipped many of our gods and demigods in the form of animal-headed humans, such as the cat god Mirir, who they knew as Sekhet, goddess of joy. The Jatarians also believed strongly in the power of charms. The cult of the cobra practiced the curse magic of their long-dead high priests, and you will no doubt need amulets and talismans to protect you from their spells."
You ask Lopar how he knows so much about the sect and the history of Jarat.
"I was not always as I appear now," he says somberly. "When I was a foolish young scholar with a lust for knowledge searching in the desert, I stumbled upon some of the ruins of that once great civilization. I filled my mind with everything and anything I could discover about the race. But I pried too far and disturbed the resting place of a high priestess of Cythera. Inadvertently, I released her spirit into the world and suffered her cruel vengeance before I managed to banish her spectre. However, if you do not stop the cult, and if Acheris should be returned to this world, the fate of hundreds of innocent people will be much worse than mine. Do all you can to thwart their nefarious plans."
Do you have any items in your possession that you wish to ask Lopar about?
I do not.
I believe in travelling light, to the extent of not even taking food with me. Otherwise, the shaman says to you,
"Now lie down beside this fire and sleep. You still have a long way to go before you meet your destiny."
You wake as the sun is rising over the eastern hills. You are lying in the middle of a dusty track that wends its way northwestwards through the wilderness. Behind you, many kilometres away on the horizon, you can see the silhouette of Spirit Rock. Lopar has helped you once more on your quest. Regain 1 luck point and 2 stamina points. So, stamina now 14. Luck now 12. With renewed vigour, you proceed on your way. Under Glantanka's unrelenting gaze, you travel on through the heat of the day.
The uneven path leads you further into the wilderness that fringes the Desert of Skulls. You follow the route northwestwards across the boulder-strewn hills and through narrow valleys. As you pass through one rocky gully, you notice a large hole at its base leading underground. Do you want to stop and investigate this entrance into the earth, or will you continue on your way without hesitation? I think we'll investigate. I kind of want some stuff now. I feel as though I'm missing out by not having any stuff. The hole is actually the entrance to a natural tunnel. The air inside it is hot and dry. The tunnel does not go very far before it opens into a small cavern. At this time of day, the sun's rays penetrate even this subterranean chamber. Suddenly you hear the grating sound of scale on stone and the scratching of claws. You spin around to see a large reptilian creature with a long, dragon-like head and a fang-filled mouth running at you from out of the shadows on six crocodile legs. A black tongue snakes out from between the rasaur's jaws as it dashes towards you. You must fight this carnivorous reptile. So the rasaur has a skill of 8 and a stamina of 9, and if it wins an attack round, roll 1 die on a roll of a 4 to 6, and will hit with its tongue, on the end of which is a poison gland, which deducts a further stamina point and adds 1 to your poison score. So, with slight feeling of unease, I will roll some dice. I have defeated the rasaur. It hit me twice and poisoned me once, so my stamina is now 9 and my poison score is now 3. Once again, I'm really not rolling at all well today. Wiping the lizard's blood from your sword, you survey the cavern. On the far side, you can see a mound of loose earth with a hollow in the top, in which rest 2 sandy-coloured eggs. Around the nest are scattered the bones of wild dogs and even pieces of a human skeleton. Do you want to search the debris? I certainly do, on the grounds that otherwise I've been poisoned for nothing. Buried under the piles of bones, you unearth the remains of a backpack that you presume belonged to the unfortunate human. Looking inside, you find a small notebook. Opening it, you discover that it is a diary or journal. From what you can make out, its owner was among the band of explorers, one of whom tumbled into Jeren Farr's camp 8 days ago. That is a nice little callback. The diary contains information about their progress to the temple, but you also read something else of interest. On their journey, the group came upon some ruins, which they believed to be Juratian. On one section of wall, they found an inscription in a strange picture script. It is reproduced in the diary. There is nothing else of interest, but before leaving, you decide to take the Rasaur's 2 eggs with you, each of which will provide a meal in itself. We now have 2 provisions. Vindicated in my decision not to go shopping. Apart from that time I starved to death. Dusk falls, and still you have not sighted the temple. Here on the fringes of the Desert of Skulls, the nights are as freezing as the days are scorching. Do you have a yokka egg? I do not. I've got 2 rasaur eggs, but no yokka eggs. Otherwise, do you want to build a fire to keep warm, assuming you have some means of lighting one, which I don't? Or would you rather not risk attracting the attention of nocturnal hunters? This is going so well. I will definitely decide that it's a better plan not to attract the attention of nocturnal hunters. That's the reason why I'm not lighting a fire. It has nothing to do with not being able to. The night is numbingly cold and you are barely able to sleep at all. In the morning you feel worse than you did when you settled down the night before. Deduct 2 points from your stamina. Stamina now 7. As the feeling returns to your limbs with the rising sun's warming rays, you consult Jeren's map. It shows that you must now head directly north for the temple. I do appreciate that this game book does allow you to just meander out into the wilderness completely and totally unprepared for what you find there and just suffer the consequences. It's a small thing. I mean, it only really eats a single paragraph by allowing you the option to leave rapidly
Maybe not even that. I mean, maybe this is a decision that costs you zero paragraphs, in fact, if you're going to get filtered to the same exit point from the city anyway. You're just going there early. So, yeah, it adds a great deal to this adventure without costing anything. And creates a sense of immersion, because part of immersion is the freedom to make genuinely stupid decisions, as I have on this recorded playthrough. You have not travelled many kilometres before you reach the top of a ridge of a line of hills and find yourself looking out over a wide valley. The land drops steeply down to the sand-coloured valley floor, and there, only a few hundred metres away, lie the fallen pillars and broken walls of a temple half buried by the desert. At last, you have found it. In front of the temple is a sparkling oasis surrounded by palm trees, its clear waters looking very inviting after your days of hot and dusty travel. Here you hope you will discover the location of Acharis's tomb. Will you make first for the oasis or the ruins? Let's go for the oasis first. After days of wandering through the dust and heat of the desert hills, it makes a pleasant change to walk across a carpet of foliage between the trees at the edge of the pool. The cool waters of the oasis look even more tempting and refreshing now. Do you want to pause to drink here, or will you leave the lush watering hole to explore the temple ruins straight away? Let's have a little wee swally of oasis water. Surely that can't be poison. It is poison. Kneeling down at the water's edge, you cup your hands together and, having dipped them into the pool, gulp down a great mouthful. Almost instantly, your stomach is seized by a terrible burning pain. The water of the oasis is poisoned. You writhe around in agony for several minutes before the acute pain passes, but you are left feeling weak and nauseous. Deduct 4 points from your stamina and add 2 to your poison score. So, stamina now 3. Guess I'm going to eat an egg until I feel better. So I'll reduce my provisions by 1 and return my stamina to 7. I'm going to have to go through this at some point and try and work out if it's possible to actually hit the poison max of 18 without having lost just far too much stamina to be survivable. Because my feeling is that there's every possibility that to get to 18, you may actually take too much stamina damage to survive. I guess it depends how many provisions you can get and whether there's any other healing available en route. Yeah, it might be difficult to actually work that out. But yes, another example of the poison system demonstrating it doesn't need to massively be there by taking out your stamina at the same time. Once you feel able to continue again, you leave the treacherous oasis to explore the ruined remains of the temple. All that remains of the temple are sections of crumbling stone walls and the occasional colonnade of rounded pillars. Broken statues of strange animal-headed deities protrude from heaps of drifted sand, while worn carvings adorn fallen stone slabs. An unnatural stillness pervades this place. The only sound you can hear is the desert wind keening through the ancient columns. Wandering among the ruins, you come to a part of the temple that is not in ruins. Entering the building, you discover that its interior is dimly lit by daylight streaming in through cracks in the roof. The walls of the temple are covered with stylized paintings of humans and semi-human figures. A repeated theme appears to be that of a king praying, making offerings, or conversing with an assortment of gods and goddesses. At last you come to a chamber in which, carved on one wall, is a map of the area around the temple at the edge of the Desert of Skulls. Although it is recognisable as such, there are several obvious differences. Pictures of buildings and other sites have been carved as part of the map, and at the top of the wall there is a Duratian inscription. You study the inscription to try and work out the location of Acharis' tomb. If you can, you will know how many kilometres it is to Acharis' tomb. Turn to the paragraph with the same number to continue your adventure. Otherwise, your adventure ends here, as you have no idea where to start looking for the tomb. Soon, you
and many others will suffer from the curse of Acheris. So I guess that will be the end, because I'm looking at the picture on the facing page, which shows a nice map. You can see the oasis on it. It's been divided into squares. I can see how many squares it is to the tomb, I think. 1, 2, 3, 4. But I cannot make head nor tail of the inscription above, or indeed the picture below, which shows a pair of animal-headed gods, one of whom appears to be holding a spirit level. That could be relevant as well in some way, I guess. I'm assuming the code to the puzzle must be something to do with counting the number of times a particular motif appears, perhaps. I can see there are some repeating motifs. But yeah, I can't make head nor tail of it, so I need to go back and start again from the beginning, and this time play a bit better. So, a thoroughly ignominious end to this recorded playthrough, but I had a lot of fun with it. I'm really looking forward to going back into this one. It feels like much more of a classic fighting fantasy book than some of the more experimental titles we've seen so far, but I'll need to delve into its mysteries to see if that's truly the case. A lovely time had. I'm going to go away, I'm going to play through it, and I'm going to be back for you in just a few moments with some closing remarks. Tatty bye. Having finished Curse of the Mummy, it's arguably not the perfect way to finish the original run, but it is perhaps the most appropriate way to finish the original run. There is so much I like about this book, but also much that frustrates me, to the extent that I do feel it encapsulates almost everything that fighting fantasy has to offer. It is joyous and frustrating in equal measure. In outline, you've got the classic setup of a weird dead dude on his way back to menace the land of the living, only with an Egyptian twist. You're off on a short walking holiday before descending into a dungeon to set things right. Along the way, you'll be fighting a lot of monsters, answering riddles, dodging traps, and collecting sundry items with numbers attached to them, before the final showdown with the undead monstrosity himself. If we're looking at the good elements first, this feels like one of the fresher books in the later series, in that it does a solid job of ripping off the real world while still being very recognisably set in a fantastic one. There's a lot of references to thinly veiled Egyptian mythology, but there's also a bunch of internal references to the established mythology of Titan, which helps to keep it feeling like part of the fantasy world we know. There's a few creatures from the classic fighting fantasy bestiary in there as well to really hammer that point home. All of this means that the adventure feels very cohesive in theme throughout. The Tomb of Acheris in particular has a very strong thematic identity, which made me feel like I was exploring a tomb designed for a madman, which is, I think, exactly what the author intended. There's a decent variety of monsters, traps, and evocative set pieces throughout the tomb, and I really enjoyed coming across all of them. Throughout the dungeon delve, I was constantly looking forward to finding out what strange dangers were lurking around the next corner, and I felt constantly propelled forward in the story. It's something that Jonathan Green's style makes very easy to enjoy. He's one of the stronger prose writers in the field, with a knack for pulling out the salient details of a scene to paint it vividly. He manages to make the different areas all feel visually distinct, while staying true to that Egyptian ambience he's settled on. He's got a good imagination, and he clearly knows enough about the source material to do more than simply rehash a series of cinematic clichés. You can collect earthenware jars with Acheris's mummified organs in them, and come across one part of his soul haunting a sarcophagus. And these are the kind of details that I absolutely love. The dungeon itself is relatively pleasant to explore. The big areas are so well described that I found it straightforward to remember more or less where I'd been before, which is, I think, the hallmark of really good dungeon writing. It's not especially complex as a space, and it manages to be fairly linear, but neither does it feel like a corridor full of doors. There's just enough twists and turns to make it feel as though you're exploring a space, but not so many that I was constantly confused by the layout, and not so many that at any point I felt I had to draw a map. There's one big caveat to that, which I'll get into later, but in general, I found the overall conception of the dungeon strong, even though there are a few elements doing their best to undercut those positives. Along the way, you're going to find a good assortment of classic dungeon traps, from the spike-filled pit to the magical statue that comes to life when you mess with the treasure. You can also end up in a room filling with sand and another room where the ceiling is coming down to crush you. All good stuff straight out of Indiana Jones. There is a nice balance between the different encounters, from fights to traps to puzzles and the occasional NPC, mostly, it has to be said, ghosts, which, honestly, in a tomb is fair enough. There are some issues with the fights, mostly that there's too many, but one thing Green has done is create little moments of narrative for many of them, which are mechanically very simple, but make them stick in the mind. Blowing a horn, accidentally summoning additional ant centaurs to a fight when you thought it might scare them off is a cool moment, as are various fights where you can use a flaming torch to try and deal more damage to dry, dusty undead in exchange for a small skill penalty. Although the poison mechanic is flawed, it adds an undeniable level of additional threat to several fights, and I really like that. Even something as simple as slipping over at the start of the fight, which happens a couple of times, helps to add a sense of story to the dice, and that's always a good thing. It helps focus your mind on what the dice are simulating, which is a life and death struggle. Like most people, I consider puzzles to be fair when I can solve them and unfair when I can't. I didn't massively struggle with anything here, which suggests to me that they're about right. Your mileage, of course, may vary. They're also fairly well incorporated into the story. A shaman testing you with a riddle, that's a classic. Working out how to find the tomb from clues you've gathered so far, that feels appropriate. And then a sphinx claiming that it's asking you riddles feels entirely appropriate, even though actually it's just asking you a set of quiz questions about who built the tomb and the identity of a specific god. There are a lot of items in this book. Too many items, but we'll get to that. What's nice is that several items can be used in several different places. That's something I always appreciate because it just makes the world feel more real to me. Added to which, many items are useful, but you can still theoretically get past the challenges without them. Although this book is hard, and we'll definitely get to that, there's a bunch of nice touches where items get their chance to shine without it automatically being the end of the adventure if you don't have them. Fire is always going to be handy, but the rope and grapple more than justify the inclusion at various points, my favourite being the one that lets you swing Indiana Jones style over a chasm. I'm a big fan of using items more than once, because it does make them feel more like tools than keys that open one particular door. Added to this, the closing sections of the book are exceptionally exciting. The final showdown with Acheris plays out like the closing scenes of an action movie, as you find yourself captured by cultists, menaced by mummies, and then taking on first the High Priestess and then the rejuvenated Acheris himself in a fight that can see you trying all manner of desperate ploys to even the odds before throwing hands with the big bad. And that's followed by your classic escape the collapsing tomb before you're buried alive with your nemesis. It's marvellous stuff. And overall, this is a book that does a good job of providing a sense of freedom while also having a narrative thrust to it. The business with Jeryn Farr at the start and the final confrontation provide satisfying storytelling bookends, and then in the middle you're much more left to your own devices and you get more of that board game feel to it. So it manages to straddle both worlds really nicely. With all of that said, it's time to talk about my issues with the book. The elephant in the room is the difficulty, and it's a massive elephant decked out with armour and a howdah full of goblins with axes. This book is brutal. This book wants to beat you like you owe it money. It's hard on every conceivable metric. Those optional items I talked about, secretly they aren't actually that optional because you'll want every last drop of stamina you can lay your hands on. Plus, of course, there's a whole bunch of absolutely required items on top of that. The search for stuff is utterly relentless. You'll need to rummage down the back of every single couch you come across, even if that couch is made of knives and on fire. The item fiesta starts off with a trip to the market, which always annoys me by this point, where there's 9 items competing for your attention and the contents of your wallet. The actor Crano has a further 6, making 15 potential items before you've really got to the end of the first act. I think what winds me up about this is that it might as well tell you that you aren't making it through your first couple of playthroughs if you didn't pick exactly the right items somehow on the very first try. And also, it just feels like a chore. I don't think anyone looks forward to going to the big Tesco's at the weekend, so it baffles me why that's become such a staple in the fighting fantasy books. And one of the things that's extremely frustrating in this book is how hard some of the items are to get. With the book being fairly linear, exploring itself isn't a massive issue, although it's still a bit draining knowing that you have to exhaustively explore the whole dungeon. Rather, it's just that there's a constant parade of skill, luck, and stamina tests lining up to try and stop you getting anywhere or finding anything useful. A lot of the fights feel absolutely brutal too, and that's even with the wizard re-release that makes a few of the enemies a bit easier. Perhaps the best illustration is that even if you make it through to the end of the book, you still have to pass a mandatory luck test to make it out alive. Hope you didn't spend any luck on that final confrontation with Acheris, whose skill starts at 13. I mean, sure, you can knock him down a few points if you've collected enough jars filled with his mummified remains, but he's still going to have a skill of 11 at the very easiest. Did I mention that before you pass the luck test, you also need to pass a skill test, adding +1 to the roll? Obviously, that is also fatal should you fail the roll. Now, you've almost certainly got a skill of 12 to make it that far in the book, so it's not a huge problem, and you'll need to roll a double 6 to fail, but it's still another kick in the teeth from a book that bought a lifetime supply of steel-toe cap Doc Martens. The various tests and the item checks and the hard fights just feel relentless. I honestly gave up on playing honestly after my second attempt, which is very early for me. You're looking at a low chance to beat this book, even with maximum stats. And even if you're cheating, the sheer volume of fights and tests in the text won't let you forget that this book hates you and wants you dead. It is just exhausting. While we're on the subject of exhausting, there is a maze! Because, of course, there's a maze. It's not a terrible maze by any means, being quite short, but it's another example of one of my least favourite tropes rearing its ugly head. There's probably someone out there who really loves a gamebook maze, and if I ever meet them, I'll ask for a signed statement to that effect so that I can occasionally take it out and look on it in awe and stupefaction at the glorious variety of human experience. And while we're on the subject of irritations, there's also the old chestnut of turning names into numbers, adding them together, and turning to the paragraph that they sum to. It's clunky and irritating, and it gets worse the more you have to do it, and you have to do it quite a lot. It doesn't help that some of these names are only vaguely signposted, so you end up having to write everything down that you think could potentially be turned into a code later, which slows your progress down still further. And this goes back to something I've said before, ambiguous game operations are bad design. If something is going to be relevant later, you should tell the player in the text. Tell them to write it down on their character sheet, or better yet, create a keyword. Do something to indicate that it has a gameplay function beyond just being a description of the world. I use capital letters for gameplay items and keywords in my books to make it absolutely clear that they are functional artifacts within the game. There's nothing more annoying than successfully finding the dragon-headed staff, only to get to the part where the staff is useful and be asked what colour its tongue is, or the middle name of the merchant who sold it to you. You've got the item, you should be able to use the item. With all of this difficulty, at least poison seems to be a functional irrelevance. I think you're going to run out of stamina well before the poison gets you. Everything I said about it being a redundant second stamina bar is more or less right. 18 is a weirdly big poison total to get to as well. That is a lot of poison to ingest one way or another. Honestly, it is a relief that it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of the game book. I think Daggers of Darkness managed to do something faintly interesting with a poison mechanic, whereby the poison acted more the more exertion you did. It wasn't quite acting as just a second stamina bar. There was something else going on that helped differentiate it from your stamina total. A poison is not the worst mechanic, but ultimately, most of the time, just knocking off some stamina will get you to the same point without multiplying the underlying mechanics. If you want to do a second stamina bar, I think you want to do something that acts in a different way. And I guess something that feels more like radiation, something that's more of an environmental threat, is the sort of area that I'm thinking it might be worth doing. I could definitely see a science fiction book where you have a radiation score that goes up as you head through particularly irradiated areas, and this is fine until you hit a certain threshold. So in Curse of the Mummy, we have another little oddity, really, to finish the original run. It's a fun Egyptian-themed adventure, marred by punishing difficulty and some obtuse design decisions, as well as a few of my personal least favourite tropes. Overall, though, I am going to say that the good definitely outweighs the bad. Cheat like an MP filling in their expenses, and there is a great deal of fun to be had here. The core adventure is so solid, and there's lots of imagination gone into the presentation. If the difficulty had been streamlined, if there were multiple ways to get to the end, I think this could have been a Stone Cold classic. It's not that far off still being a Stone Cold classic. As it is, what we have is a summary of everything that works and quite a lot that doesn't work. Where does this leave us looking back over the last 59 books? Well, there's great stuff all the way through the run, but I do think that many of the best books are the early ones. It seems to me that there is a clarity of focus in books like Citadel of Chaos, Forest of Doom, City of Thieves, House of Hell, and Death Trap Dungeon. You can see it in some of the other books authored by guest writers. Demons of the Deep and Sword of the Samurai leap out as great examples of books with a really focused approach to the kind of story they want to tell. Yet, even outside the first 20, the quality is still there, albeit intermittently. Beneath Nightmare Castle, Vault of the Vampire, Midnight Rogue, Legend of the Shadow Warriors, those are all books I remember very fondly. But it's hard to escape the feeling that the series was generally willing to settle for books that fitted into a fairly familiar formula. And it's a good formula. And the relative failure of the science fiction titles was probably instrumental in them playing safe with these fantasy adventures where you're off to find a couple of items and deal with a threat from centuries before. It's fine as a setup, but it does start to feel a little bit familiar. And one thing I really liked about Curse of the Mummy was that it seemed to have regained something of that clarity of focus. Let's do a big grave robbing in a pyramid is a perfectly sound starting point for a game book, and in general those that focus on a specific mood, a specific genre, or an implied historical setting have often been my favourite game books in the series. And Curse of the Mummy is properly memorable, which is a problem with quite a lot of the books in the later run. So I'll definitely raise a glass to Jonathan Green for penning a book that, yeah, lingers in the memory even when some others have faded into a homogeneous mass. And how splendid that this wasn't the end. Despite everything, fighting fantasy still refuses to die. That is a source of tremendous encouragement to me. And here is to it continuing in some form or another for many years to come. It's been a privilege to hit this milestone, and that's partly thanks to the encouragement I've received from my listeners. There's the very welcome financial support from my patrons, but also I've had so many kind messages over the years that have helped me hit my schedule even when I wasn't really feeling it. So thank you to everyone who's listened, particularly if you've listened to every single episode. I salute you. From the perspective of this podcast, the next order of business is going to be Steve Jackson's ambitious sorcery sequence, and then we're going to get stuck into some of the newer titles. When they run out, there's the entire Lone Wolf series to play through. You can pry this podcast microphone from my cold, dead hands. But that's for the future. Next time, we're going to be saying another farewell as we finish off the Way of the Tiger series. That should be good. If you want to get in touch with me, you can do so by emailing me at hjdoomretrofun, all one word, @gmail.com, or by following me on Blue Sky. Thank you so much for listening. Take care, and I'll see you soon.